American Revolution history, Charlotte officials, toilets. Which listener-submitted topic do you want us to report on for our next FAQ City podcast? Cast your vote and contribute your own question on WFAE.org/FAQ City. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On Tuesday, Carl Kassel, a veteran broadcaster, longtime NPR newscaster, and the official scorekeeper for NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, died in Potomac, Maryland at the age of 84 after a battle with Alzheimer's disease. Here's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me host Peter Sagal as he remembers his friend Carl Kassel.
The day I met Carl Kassel in 1998, he just reached out and shook my hand and said my name. And then he said it again. I think he knew how exciting it is for all of us public radio nerds to hear our name spoken by that voice, and he wanted to give me a gift. Carl was in his early 60s then, already an institution in the news business, at an age when he could think about retiring. But instead, he began a second career.
From outside the newsroom, from way outside the newsroom, it's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
We needed him on this show because if Carl Kassel was involved, it was serious. It was important. But as soon as he had the chance, Carl dropped that serious newsman persona because what he really was and really wanted to be was funny.
I live alone with my cat called Pebbles. I've never been married, never been kissed. Oh, shame.
Carl Kassel was born and raised in North Carolina and can turn on that southern charm at will with time for everyone and never a sharp word to anyone ever, not once in the 16 years I knew him. He was kind down to his bones.
That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me host Peter Sagal talking about his friend Carl Kassel. Today we're going to listen back to our 2005 conversation with Carl. We welcomed the North Carolina native on Charlotte Talks in front of a live audience here at the WFAE studios.
Thank you, Mike.
Welcome back to North Carolina.
Always good to be home.
Good to see you again. The last time I saw you, you had a flat top.
I did.
Yeah.
I couldn't sport one now. There's not much up there to...
You and me both. We both worked. I was a kid. I was in college, or just out of college, or I guess I was in college still, and worked over the summer at WAVA,
right.
WAVA, Arlington, Washington, a service of Arundel Communications.
Exactly.
And you were there, and you were the king of the newsroom even then.
We had fun. You know, I was a DJ early on in my career and moved to the Washington area about 1965 and worked in Alexandria playing records in the morning. Then I got a chance.
WPIK?
WPIK. And I was called by a friend whom I'd met earlier. He worked at WAVA. He said, "We need somebody who can read on the weekend, part-time job, are you interested? I could use the money." So I took the job. And I guess within 2 years, I was full-time at WAVA. I left the records behind, and I embarked on a new career, something I really had no desire to do, news.
Yeah.
Because in the early days, I thought it was quite boring. I'd rather sit down and play records, put together a program, have fun, do the weather, the time, and so forth.
You know.
And now here I am doing the news. But it was an exciting time, though, Mike, because, we had the assassinations. Right. We had weekly demonstrations in Washington, anti-Vietnam War demonstrations, the Middle East War in the 60s, and a lot of things were happening. It was exciting, and it was a good time to learn a new craft.
I was reading all about you yesterday in preparation for this, and the more I read, the more I realized that we had so much in common, because one of the things you just said, that you got into radio to play records and have a good time, so did I. I never thought in a million years I'd be having serious conversations about serious topics. I just wanted to play Frank Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald records. That's all I wanted to do. And here you are doing the news on NPR. And back at WAVA, it was a different operation. It was a kind of a rip and read.
It was.
Half hour on for each anchor, half hour off to prepare. Mm-hmm. And underneath the desk, there was a piece of tape in a continuous loop.
Uh-huh.
And every time you turned the mic on...
It was the ticker, news machine. The ticker tape.
Right. All fake. you've been in this business for 50 years, or 53 years, 54 years.
55. Yeah.
What made you want to get into it in the first place?
Because of what I was listening to on the air when I was just a tyke before I went to school. I loved the radio. I would sit and listen to it in the evening, time after time. In the afternoon, the kids' programs that came on, you know, those adventure stories, Superman, right. The Lone Ranger, Captain Midnight, and all of them. I listened to those programs. And it had that fascination that I thought one day I would love to do that. Mm-hmm. But I probably won't do it. But we had a great high school drama department when I got older, and they had a connection with a local radio station, WGBR. And my voice was changing about the time I was in Goldsboro, about the time I was 16. And we had a weekly high school news program on the station, and I auditioned, and I got to read the news. And I did it several times, and that summer they offered me a part-time job. And I was in heaven, and I've been there ever since.
Who were your heroes early on in radio, your broadcast?
Don Gardner was one. He was ABC, listening in the morning, ABC. Local people I worked with, Darren Ward, Bob Hill, and several others that I tried to emulate.
Yes.
I wanted to do what they do and be like them. And in a way, you do kind of copy them because of what they do. But I learned later on, that's fine, because even though you are copying them, your own personality is going to come through anyhow, and that's how you develop a style.
It's exactly how I did it. I sounded like, people here won't know these people, but I tried to sound like Tom Gager and Bill Trumbull on WMAL in Washington.
Right. Yeah.
And you just find out what pieces of them fit you and what don't, and you shed the ones that don't fit, and you keep the ones that do.
And then you finally are on, just be yourself.
Yeah. Tell me about the first experience as a DJ. I read that the first experience, and I mentioned this in the opening minute, was being a DJ using your grandmother's Victrola. My first experience was using my mother's 45 RPM RCA record player.
Well, I'm older than you, so. my grandmother had a wind-up Victrola. You had to change the needle after every record you played.
Wow.
And I would sit there and play. We only had one record. I'd play that thing over and over, flip it over, play the other side, flip it over, play it again, and just play radio. And that's what I did when I finally got on the air. I played radio.
Yeah. Well, that's what it is. Play.
Yeah, it is.
There's no heavy lifting.
No.
And it's not real. I've never had a real job. Have you ever had a real job?
No. Beats working for a living.
Yeah. Yeah. That's because it's not a real job. Have you really ever had a real job?
No.
Okay.
Well, I'll put that. Let's go back a little further. When I was before radio, I worked at the neighborhood grocery store.
Yeah.
I delivered groceries on a bicycle. And then as I got older, they let me back in the meat department. I could slice pork chops with the best and slice steak. Oh, yeah.
Well, then you have had a real job.
I had a real job.
I can't do anything. Darn. You know, this state has given America a lot of really wonderful journalists. Mm-hmm. You, Charles Kuralt,
right.
David Brinkley. And I think...
Charlie Rose.
Uh-huh. And am I wrong about this? Is Edward R. Murrow, is he from here, too?
I think he was born elsewhere, but he spent a lot of his time in North Carolina. I'm not sure about that.
Even just the first four we mentioned.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
With just those people, what is it about North Carolina and journalism, do you think?
Well, we have a lot of print journalists, too, who came from here. You go to the North Carolina Journalism Hall of Fame in Chapel Hill, and it's full of people. From my hometown, Henry Belk, for one, who ran the Goldsboro News Argus. You got Tom Wicker. Then you go back to Thomas Wolfe.
Wow.
And his writings. Yeah. A lot of good writers came from the state.
Must
be something in the air.
Storytelling? The need to tell stories?
I guess so. We like to tell stories.
Yeah. And you said that you didn't get into the business to play, to do the news. You thought it was boring. Mm-hmm. When did you realize that it wasn't? Or what was it about doing it every day that changed your mind about it? Because you wouldn't still be doing it after all this time if you didn't like it.
Well, at WAVA, that changed me a lot, because so much was happening at that time.
That was it.
So much was going on, and I was a part of it. And being in Washington, we were in contract with government officials and the big departments there, and that held a fascination, too. Got to go out and meet some of these people. I remember the first time I went to the White House with our news director, Chuck Van Dyke. He took me over to, you know Chuck?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He gave me the tour of the White House press room. Fascinating. And I sat in for a briefing. And it was great. So I was hooked.
Yeah. Charles Van Dyke's the guy that hired me, God knows why.
Uh-huh.
And because I was terrible. Oh, gosh, I was terrible. You know, I was reading about you yesterday, and one of the things it says is that you've won an award for the most... the fewest mistakes on the air. People don't realize how difficult it is because you're working under deadlines and sometimes you don't get to read the copy. And at WAVA, it was a rip and read operation.
It was,
came off the teletype, you ripped it off, you read it. And I couldn't, and it was that period of time when they were going to those quiet teletypes that didn't have any print. The print head was this little dot matrix thing that used carbon paper.
Yep.
And I couldn't read it. I could not say a whole sentence without stumbling. And you've never made a mistake in your life, have you?
No. I'm not confessing anything.
Because I've never heard you make a mistake. I mean, I really haven't.
The times I do, the phones begin to ring, the email starts coming in. And I've often said, going to visit like WFAE, to meet people like we have here today, to put a face to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And they look about like I thought they'd look. You know.
What does that mean?
Put a face to the audience.
They're all wearing clothes, by the way, for those of you listening
at
home.
Then I know I'm not talking to four walls. Yeah. I'm sure you've had that feeling, too.
Right.
Is anybody out there listening to what I'm doing? Make a mistake, and you know immediately that you have an audience.
Well, there's some comfort sometimes in just talking to the four walls
mm-hmm.
because you really don't think there's anybody out there listening, so it's okay, whatever happens.
But I've known broadcasters who deliberately make a mistake just to see if there is anybody listening. A small mistake, you know.
And I suppose there were some stations that you worked at early in your career where there was the distinct possibility that there was no one listening, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because there was for me. WSMD in La Plata, Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
I'm convinced that there's no one listening because I once hit the wrong button and put the station off the air during the middle of an Orioles baseball game and nobody called.
Nobody missed you.
Nobody called. What was the first place you worked at professionally?
That was in Goldsboro, WGBR, my hometown station. Good station, very good station, had good coverage, and they put you in there, and you did what you wanted. And we played, I worked primarily in the morning, and we'd start, sign on the air, not 24 hours in those days, sign on at 6 o'clock, and you play country music early in the morning for the farmers who get up. 7 o'clock, you switch to popular music, and then by midday, we used to have the Breakfast Club on from ABC.
Don McNeil.
Mm-hmm. And then around 10 o'clock, up until noon, you had midday music for the housewife, you know, who's at home sewing, whatever she's doing. And then at noon, you have local news and then a little country music then. And by the afternoon, you're back to popular. And then at night, you're playing easygoing music, romantic music. Did it all.
You were the one guy?
Well, at one time or another, I did it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ran through the whole
day clock.
Did you have a preference? Did you care?
I liked the morning.
What's wrong with you? You've been getting up at what?
There's nobody there.
2:33.
You're by yourself.
That is true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
From the broadcaster's point of view, the management doesn't arrive until you're almost done.
And it is prime time for radio. More people listen in the morning than they do any other time of day. So you got the bigger audience.
But it ruins your life. You've been getting up at what, 3:30, 2:30 in the morning?
I get up at 1 o'clock now. Actually, I get up at 1:10. Now, you ask me why I don't get up at 1 o'clock.
Why don't you get up at 1 o'clock?
I like to sleep late.
You know I'm not a good straight man, am I? We're listening back to our 2005 conversation with NPR's Carl Kasell. The beloved NPR newscaster and North Carolina native died this week at the age of 84. We'll have more of our conversation in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Hey, Charlotte Talks fans. How do you listen to the Charlotte Talks podcast? Take our 5-minute survey right now on WFAE.org. We appreciate it.
It's Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Longtime NPR newscaster and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me official scorekeeper Carl Kasell died on Tuesday at the age of 84. His fans across the country included NPR listeners, celebrities, even politicians. Here's a special message to Carl back in 2014 from one of those politicians, then-President Barack Obama.
Hi, everybody. This is Barack from Washington, D.C. Carl, for 30 years on Morning Edition, yours was the voice America woke up to. You brought us the news of everything from presidential elections to the fall of the Berlin Wall. We trusted you to tell us what happened and why it mattered. And then for some reason you joined a show where Peter Siegel makes you read goofy limericks and imitate everybody from Britney Spears to Barack Obama. It turns out they all sound like Carl Castle. Anyway, we're glad you did. Over the years, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me has become an institution in my hometown of Chicago and across the country. And Carl, you've been its heart and soul. I will never forget my time on the show. A lot of people didn't know my name, but you guys were already making fun of it. So, Carl, congratulations on an incredible career and a well-deserved retirement. We will miss you, but it's good to know you won't be giving up everything. Who knows, maybe in a few years you'll get a call from another contestant, Barack from Chicago. And if I win, I'm glad you will still record my voicemail.
This hour, we're listening back to our 2005 conversation with Carl Castle, recorded in front of a live audience at WFAE. We talked about everything from barbecue and his love of magic tricks to his North Carolina roots and his long career from the very beginnings.
It's the Carl Castle Show.
With tops and tunes and Goldsboro Radio.
Carl Castle plays the best.
The tunes that are your favorite requests.
WGBR is the place to dial no matter where you are. 1150 Carl Castle Show.
The Carl Castle Show.
All right, everybody, let's dance. I don't know where we got that, but I'd burn it if I were you.
Oh, that's a treasure.
Oh, sure it is.
Keep it.
What if, you know, when you work at a radio station, like a top 40 radio station, and they give you a jingle with your name on it.
I know.
You know you're set.
Yeah, I know I've made it.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Unless it says Bob Raleigh, then you know you're just one of a string of Bob Raleighs who come yeah, the way. Yeah. You went to Chapel Hill, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And you palled around with Charles Carroll.
Yeah. I knew Charlie. We did a lot of work together for the campus station, WUNC, which mm-hmm. today is a public radio station. And we also did some work for WCHL, the commercial station.
Yeah, that was a big one in Chapel Hill. That's a big station. Still is an important station today.
Yeah. It was a daytime operation only then. Mm-hmm. And I used to open the station up in the morning during the last year I was in school. Mm-hmm. And which I didn't in Goldsboro for a while. I opened up the station and go to school and did the same thing in Chapel Hill.
Again, mornings.
Mornings. Best time to work. Nobody around.
What time are you done?
My last newscast is 11 o'clock mm-hmm. in the morning, and I'm out of there by 11:30. Maybe a few things to...
And your first newscast is at...
5 o'clock.
5 o'clock, and you get there at...
Around 2.
Why? It takes 3 hours to put together 5 minutes of news?
Well, No. I got to make coffee. I've got to see if there's any food around.
Yeah.
I've got to read my email. It's all in preparation, Mike. The work comes in the preparation.
Exactly right.
Like for this show, you prepare for this show a lot.
Well, that's what I tell them.
That's what you tell them. Doing it is not the hard part.
No, the hard part is preparing.
It's
exactly
preparation.
Right.
So it's a preparation. So I start looking at the wires early and seeing what's there and making decisions and what to write about.
I want to talk about process in a little while, but I'm more interested in you as a person and what drives you, because you were like me. You were also an actor
at one point
in your life.
Mm-hmm, right.
You did some things on radio. Mm-hmm. And I'm told that you performed at the Lost Colony.
One summer I was in the Lost Colony.
What did you do? What was your part?
I played the Indian chief, Juan Cheese. They call him Juan Keys nowadays. Mm-hmm. But he was the one, you know, there were two Indians that Sir Walter Raleigh had brought back from the New World, Juan Cheese and Manteo, Chief Manteo, to present to the Queen, her new subjects. And I was one of them, Juan Cheese. And he went back to Roanoke Island when that was over with and found out that his brother had been killed by the colonists. And he turned against the white man at that point and caused all sorts of problems. Mm-hmm. And I was the one who did that.
So one summer was enough?
Well, that was between high school and college.
Okay.
So I was invited back the following year, but it was a problem of going to school right. and paying for that, and I had to stick around and work to make money to pay for school, so I couldn't go back to the law school.
It's also a nighttime job.
Yeah.
Yeah, nighttime. They're good. Don't want that. So would you consider yourself to be an extrovert because you're on the radio? You've been on the radio all your life, and you were an actor? And...
I don't think so.
Really?
I'm a quiet guy. I don't go out and perform. But
I'm told you're also a magician.
I do that. Uh-huh.
You do what? Sleight of hand?
A little. I've got some larger tricks. I've got a Black & Decker saw that I can saw you in half with. I've got the Chinese linking rings. You know, you snap them together, take them apart, uh-huh. And then make a chain out of them. It's a lot of fun.
Where did that interest come from?
I've always had an interest in magic, but Barry Gordimer, who works with Morning Edition,
right.
Does it, and he does it professionally. And many years ago, about 15 years ago, I guess, he would come in and try out new illusions that he had, little sleight of hand stuff. And I asked him to show me how to do it one day. And he did. And we developed a good friendship, and we developed a little act together. He had a couple of dubs that he, as a matter of fact, we did a little talent show at NPR, and we were part of it. And, we brought out the dubs from nowhere. And we also performed at the public radio convention a couple of times, too.
Really?
And we had fun doing it.
Who else was part of the talent show there? I just can't imagine Nina Totenberg doing anything like that.
Well, we sawed her in half one time. she said it tickled.
and did Robert Siegel participate?
No, I didn't think so.
No.
Jean Cochran did. She helped us out one time. Jean
really?
Did, yeah. Mm-hmm. She was quite good. We did a little levitation with her.
Sometimes broadcasters, particularly people in the news on deadlines, have to pull some rabbits out of their hat on radio as well. Let's talk about process.
Sure.
Because news is never ending. It's coming in all the time.
Yeah.
Who decides what stories lead the top of the hour newscast, how much time they're going to get, what order the stories are going to be in, how many people are involved in the process?
Okay. We have in the our shift in the morning, Dave Mattingly, who is our producer. He's like the foreman running the shop. Peter McLeod is our editor. Trina Williams edits reports that come in. And then there's Gene Cochran and me.
And you.
Dave, he works out what sound, what reports, tape reports we'll use within the show itself, within the newscast. He assigns that. We can ask him to change if we want to, but Dave knows how we feel and how it works. So we go along with I go along with what he says, and Gene and I build a newscast around that. And what goes in and the order it goes on the air is up to us.
Well, how do
but we pretty well think around? We pretty well think the same. We know what we want, and some stories just jump out at you. You know what's going to be your top story. It's obvious. Well, like today, it's going to be the inauguration.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be your lead all day long. Mm-hmm. But there's some days when nothing is happening. Like
in the whole world.
In the whole world, like nothing is going on. You'd be surprised on a holiday, especially around the Christmas and New Year's.
Right.
Nothing is going on. You kind of flip a coin. What am I going to lead with this time? You know, where's the dartboard? Let's, you know, pick it out that way. And you don't know how long. Well, as they say, no news is good news unless you have 5 minutes to fill.
That's right.
And 5 minutes can be an eternity. 1 minute can be an eternity. I look at it this way. Think about a minute now. You put an egg to boil, or you put a cup of coffee in the microwave, and you stand there and wait. And wait and wait and wait and wait. A minute can be, it can be quite long.
Yes.
And
so could 58 minutes.
And when you're reading, and sometimes I'm trying to fill out a newscast with a piece of copy I've written, and I have 30 seconds to go, and the copy, well, the computers tell you at the top how long the copy is. You know, they and it says you've got 20 seconds of copy. But Well, you learn tricks along the way and how to stretch it out, of course. You do some ad-libbing in there and
right.
throw in some extra words. And then there's also the problem, well, I've got 30 seconds of copy with only 20 seconds to go. And you learn how to, in your mind, you know your copy, you know the story, so you can edit it as you go along.
And then there are those moments when things go wrong, when you think a piece of, a 20-second actuality, a piece of tape's going to be there, and you call for it.
It doesn't be there.
And that gives you 20 extra seconds to fill.
It's not there. Hey, and as a matter of fact, when we went digital, I like this story, about 2 years ago, everything's in the computer. You feed it, you load the sound. We have to load the sound ourselves into the computer, hit a button, and it goes into the studio in the order that you want it. So when we got the system, we tried it out for a couple of months using the digital system. Mm-hmm. But we took the cassettes into the studio just as a backup in case something went wrong. Nothing went wrong during those 2 months. Everything worked fine. They said, okay, no more carts. We're going to do it the real way with the digital Monday morning. Who gets to do it first? I do.
You do. 5 o'clock.
Nothing worked. I called for something, nothing. They hit buttons, nothing happened. And I apologized. I went back to that in just a moment. And then they told me my headphones, okay, we're ready this time. I introduced it again. Nothing happened. Well, I learned a long time ago, when you go into a studio to do a newscast, you carry more copy than you'll ever use. And I had more copy that morning. I read for 8.5 minutes.
Wow.
Oh, they had it fixed by the next go-around,
but that
one morning. So, you prepare for those emergencies.
But you and Gene Cochran, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Another story. John Hockenberry, mm-hmm. remember John, used to work with mm-hmm. us in the afternoon. He went in with less than the amount of copy that he needed, and they had a problem, and he ran short, about a minute short, with nothing to say. And John says, and now, a moment of silence. You had engineers scrambling to get some music to put on.
It would seem to me that in a day and age when the major media, the New York Times and CBS mm-hmm. News and other organizations, including NPR, come mm-hmm. under attack for being quote-unquote liberal mm-hmm. or biased, that giving an individual like you or Gene mm-hmm. Cochran or whoever's doing the hourly newscast or the half-hour newscast the responsibility for deciding what the story ought to be, how much emphasis should be placed on an individual story, is an awesome responsibility and fairly dangerous, it seems to me, for you, because you could be accused of bias.
Well, of course. I think that most people who accuse us of bias nowadays don't listen. They just go by what somebody told
them.
They assume that there's a bias there. And I think we pretty well have it eliminated. We're very aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
Very aware of it. As a matter of fact, we have meetings over certain stories that we want to be sure that it is balanced.
Mm-hmm.
And especially during a political year, we got to give equal time to both sides. And we're very, very much aware of this. Like I said, meetings are held from time to time to pound it into our heads. Do it, in this way.
And you live the hourly newscast. The newscasts are separate from All Things Considered and Morning Edition.
Morning Edition.
Completely different group of people.
Yep.
So it is completely possible that what you think is the lead story may not necessarily be the lead story on Morning Edition. Or
that happens.
Does it happen?
Sure. Well, sometimes they have to do it according to the material they have. Now, my lead story, say a few days ago. Might have been an example, a Supreme Court case that morning. Now, Morning Edition may not lead with it in the first hour, but they'll do it in the second hour. So we have that.
And what
we don't think about what they're leading with. We just do what we're supposed to do, what we feel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we try to avoid using the same clip, same piece of sound, or the same reporter, say, in my newscast that you're going to hear 10 minutes later on Morning Edition doing the same thing.
Right. So there is some coordination?
Oh, yeah. We have the rundown of what they're going to be doing. We know what they're doing.
Okay.
So we have to...
Because the listeners, mm-hmm. Carl Castle comes out of the same speaker at
yep,
the same time
exactly.
that mm-hmm. Steve Inskeep and mm-hmm. Renee Montaigne do. Mm-hmm. So they just think you're all in one little room and talking to each other. Do you ever see them?
Oh, yeah. Well, basically, we are in the same area. Yeah. We have in Studio 2A, where the programs come out of, we have the in the center of the room, we have the control room. And to the left of the engineers and the director, you have a large studio where Renee may be or Steve may be. And then to the right, there's a small booth for us. So, yeah, I see them every day.
Do you talk to them?
Oh, yeah. When I run across them in the hall, yeah. Yeah, or if I over the, in their area. We're in two separate areas, two different parts of the building.
Carl Castle is our guest. Of course, the NPR, a longtime NPR newscaster that you hear every morning, almost every morning here on WFAE. I've got a couple of emails already here, as a matter of fact. Let me read one here.
All right.
Let me see. This comes from Paul Winchester, who says, my mother is from Goldsboro. My uncle Paul Flowers was in school with you.
Yes, I know.
And related the story of the great drama department in the high school to me. He said when you were in Goldsboro, your last name was pronounced with the accent on the second syllable.
Exactly. My family, up until I came along and got in broadcasting, we pronounced it Cassell. As a matter of fact, the other members of the family who live in Florida and some in South Carolina, they still say Cassell. But my drama teacher, Clifton Britton, says, ain't going to work. It has to be Castle. Carl Castle sounds better than Carl Cassell. So I changed the pronunciation, and my immediate family, they picked it up and went along.
Really?
Too. Yeah.
And if you put Carl Castle into Google, you will, among the sites that come up is this site that has all the possible permutations of the spelling of your name.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
How do you spell it?
K-A-S, one S-E-L-L, two L's.
Because I went through that website, and the very last line of the website says, and now that you've been through all this, you will never be able to accurately spell his name again. And I look back on all the places in my preparation where I'd spell your name, and I misspelled it every time because of that.
So listen, once in a while back in Washington, they'll mention my name in some item.
Mm-hmm.
If they misspell it, my son's on the computer immediately, giving them hell. And they have responded by saying, well, that's the way we have it. He says, no, you spelled it right 2 weeks ago or last month or a year or so ago, you know.
And Paul continues, Mike has a show every couple of years about barbecue, I do. Please tell him once and for all where the only real barbecue comes from.
Goldsboro.
Okay. Yeah. Wilbur's, Scott's, Wilbur's? And Griffin's, and Parker's, right?
All those. Well, Parker's is in Wilson, unless they
Does
move.
Does that count?
Oh, yeah. They're good. They're okay. Very good. Yeah.
Okay.
We'll come back in a moment with more of our 2005 conversation with Carl Castle, recorded in front of a live studio audience here at WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. This hour, we're listening back to our 2005 conversation with veteran newsman Carl Castle. He died this week in Potomac, Maryland at the age of 84 after battling Alzheimer's disease. One of the things Carl Castle's legions of fans all coveted during his time as official judge and scorekeeper for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me was Carl's voice on their outgoing voicemail message. He ended up recording over 2,000 of them over the years.
This is Carl Castle of National Public Radio News. Reliable sources report that both Mike and Carla are not available to answer the phone right now. We have verified that they do not need siding, windows, or a hot tub, and their carpets are clean. They give to charity through the office, and they don't need their picture taken. If you're still with me, leave your name and number, and they'll get back to you soon. And thanks.
Those voice messages became the must-have for many serious Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me fans and the signature prize for winners on the show, all made with a humor not exactly synonymous with a serious journalist or with NPR. During our 2005 interview with Carl, I asked him how he came to be on a quiz show when he's supposed to be a serious news broadcaster.
Well, actually, what happened was about 10 years ago, I was in Boston at a public radio program directors meeting. Mm-hmm. And we had several NPR on-air people there, and I was asked to preside at that session and introduce them one night. And I did, and I cracked a few jokes. One like that one, by the time you get up in the morning,
yes.
Like to sleep late.
The one I blew.
That joke.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of them. And afterwards, the head of the cultural division, we talked. She says, you know, you're funny. We might be able to use you. And she did. She talked it over with Bill Buesenberg, who was head of news and information at the time. And Bill had no problem with it. bridging the gap between culture and news, and so I got on the show.
Well, that's interesting, because we have another example of one of these messages.
Okay.
I'm Carl Castle from NPR, and you've reached the Mensing household. Mona won my voice on her answering machine on a news quiz radio program. Imagine, a man of my stature being given away a surprise. You don't see Bob Edwards giving his voice away, or Terry Gross, or even Daniel Shore. I feel so cheap. Oh, well. Leave your message at the tone.
So there were no concerns about jeopardizing credibility here.
It's fun. It's fun.
There's probably no one else of your stature in broadcasting who makes themselves available on answering machines. How does the union feel about this?
Well, it has nothing to do with being on the air, so they don't care.
But perhaps Dan Rather has a future after all.
as a matter of fact, I read the other day in the paper, I think Katie Couric volunteered to do it for somebody's phone because they donated something to the tsunami relief or whatever it was.
They're stealing your act.
Stealing my act. I got to talk to her.
We have a young fellow who he's been here freezing in the cold because it's pretty chilly in here.
Yeah.
And he strikes me as maybe somebody who wants to be in broadcasting someday because he forced his mother to take him out of school for this event. What's your name?
I'm Fred Irving.
Fred, do you want to be in radio?
I don't know.
Good. Keep it that way. Run for your life. What's up?
I was wondering if you had ever thought about a career in television.
Not really. I had an opportunity, I guess before we moved to Washington, and I came back from the Army. I did get a call from one of the stations in Raleigh about a possibility, but I did turn it down, and I don't regret that because I think radio is a more intimate medium to deal with the public. You don't have to stop what you're doing and watch. You can listen wherever you are, and the pictures are coming into your mind as we do what we do. So, no, not really. I've done some TV, as a guest from time to time, but that's it.
Okay. TV is about pictures and radio is about content.
Yeah. Well,
I'm serious.
I like that. Well, also, Alistair Cook quoted a young girl who one time said she preferred radio because the pictures were better. Your imagination, takes over.
And besides, you have to wear makeup. Television. We had a call from a fellow named Cameron, and I'm not sure that I understand this, but I'll read it anyway. He says, how did you get involved with, and what's written down here is WWDTM.
Is that wait, don't tell me.
Oh, wait, don't tell me.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not bright enough to be on this station.
Early for you yet.
It is early for me because I'm not a morning person. But do you enjoy it as much as you seem like you do?
Oh, yeah.
That's the question.
It's such a great thing to do. So the last thing I do on Friday, because I'll finish my 11 o'clock newscast and head upstairs, excuse me, to another studio, and we record Wait. And I walk out of the building laughing with a smile on my face. And there's such wonderful people to work with, and they're so talented, too.
Now, that comes from Chicago Public Radio, and how does it work? You're in Washington, Chicago. Are they all in Chicago but you?
No. Peter's in Chicago, but the panelists could be anywhere. Now, Roxanne Roberts would be with me in Washington, of course, but you got Charlie Pierce in Boston, Adam Felber in Los Angeles, Roy Blunt at his home, he's got a set up there. PJ could be anywhere. Paula Poundstone could be anywhere. Sue Ellicott might be in London. We don't see each other. We just hear each other.
How bizarre.
It is bizarre.
It is, isn't it?
But it works.
And every once in a while, you take the show on the road, and you are there for that.
Yeah.
You came to Raleigh a couple of months ago.
We did that in Durham, as a matter of fact. We did it in Durham about a year and a half ago.
I don't know why you'd waste your time there and not come here.
Yeah. Well, we work on coming here, too.
Okay. Yeah. It's a little joke, wasting your time. In Raleigh. So you don't see each other. What kind of preparation do you do for that? Anything at all?
I do nothing. They do all the work in Chicago. They write, they put the show together, they write the script, and it's emailed to me about 11 o'clock on a Friday morning. And I take the script, and when I finish my 11 o'clock newscast, I will call one of the producers, and we'll go over what I do. So I know exactly what they want. And then I head up to the studio, and that's it. The panelists, they don't have the script, just Peter and myself and and the production staff in Chicago.
Hayes has been waiting for, I think, quite a while. So let's bring Hayes into the picture here. Welcome.
Hi.
Just want to make it clear, I'm originally from Greensboro. I want to make it clear that Edgar R. Murrow is from Greensboro, so he's our favorite native son.
Good, thanks.
Street named after him and everything.
Thanks for that.
I know he's one of the late greats, and I just want to make sure we get credit for him.
Okay.
All righty.
Thanks for your call. I appreciate
it. Thank you, Hayes.
Thanks.
Anybody here wants to ask a question, please step up to the microphone over there so that we can all share what you have to say with the listener at large here. Go ahead. Hi. What's your name?
Hi, my name is Warren. And sometimes when I'm reading to my boys or I read to other people and I'm reading the story, it's more important for me to make sure I hit all the words and all the periods and things like that. And sometimes I'm at the end of a paragraph, I don't really understand what I just read. I look up at them and they're shaking their head. They got it. Uh-huh. To me, it meant nothing, but I got it out. Do you ever finish the story and think to yourself, did I make sense in that? Is this coming off right?
Oh, we try to get around that. we have an editor who looks at our copy, and if he doesn't understand it, then we got to do it again.
Yeah.
Or he'll make some corrections in it. And then many times I will go in the studio and try to read my copy myself beforehand. And then I'll think, that doesn't make sense. And so I'll make some changes. But you're right. If I don't understand it, I can't expect the audience to understand it.
Can I have one quick question, too?
Sure.
I was listening to NPR one time, and they had, I forget the woman that was a singer, and she used to have a real high voice. And as she matured and got older, her voice got lower. So she started singing different songs. Have you noticed your voice changing, getting lower as you get older, or just different?
I'm told it's a little deeper than it was when I was in college. And I think they're right, because I do have some tapes from when I was at WUNC in Chapel Hill. We did some a series of dramatic programs when I was there, and I ran across those tapes a few years ago, and amazingly well-preserved tapes, and
yeah.
This was back in the 1950s. And
we have them, too. Right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you do?
Yeah,
but
we couldn't identify your voice on it. We have you and Charles Corral, and we couldn't figure out whether it was really you and Charles Corral, or because there were several other people on the tape. We couldn't tell what was you.
Uh-huh.
So we chose not to play it.
Oh.
But we do know that your singing voice has matured.
Yeah.
Hello, this is Carl Castle from National Public Radio. Kristen and George are not available at this time. But before you leave a message, I'd like to sing you a little tune. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa.
I'm thinking about putting out a CD.
I think you and William Shatner.
Yeah.
Together.
I'm telling you.
And make sure that you include this on it as well.
Oklahoma, where the wind comes sweeping down the plain. Howdy, this is Carl Castle of National Public Radio. Renee and Brian can't come to the phone, so please leave a message. And remember, the farmer and the cowman should be friends.
Yahoo!
You can't top that, so we'll go to the floor. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Mike. I wonder who some of your most memorable guests on the Wait, Don't Tell Me might have been.
I think Madeline Albright is one. We found out this woman is funny. The first time she was on, and after she was on our show, then she was on The Daily Show. She was on, I think some of the David Letterman got her, and her humor came out. And we had her on the show again later on. We've had her on twice now, and she's a funny woman. But that stands out. It's been interesting to talk to people I have admired over the years, like Eartha Kitt, who's been on the show, Randy Newman, we were out there. Funny man, real funny guy. What's his name? Patrick Stewart, has been on the show.
Captain Kirk. Captain Picard.
Picard, yeah. and found out that he really is an NPR listener. And as a matter of fact, it came up. We understand, Patrick, that you have a car guy's baseball cap. Yep, wear it with pride, you know.
Wait, Don't Tell Me is remarkably successful, and it seems to be very popular. And last night I'm told that when you were speaking to a group of WFAE supporters, that's what they wanted to talk about.
Yeah, they do. It's amazing.
Do you understand that?
I think so. It's new. It's fairly new program, and we do get out, and it's an entertaining program.
Yeah.
And people connect with it very much, of all ages. I mean, young people like little Fred here listens to Wait, Wait.
And do you? Do you listen to Wait, Wait? You do? Okay.
And I ran across a young fellow last night who listens to it regularly, and it runs the gamut as far as ages are concerned. And interesting enough that after 9/11, the Saturday afterwards, that weekend, we did not do a show. We knew we'd be preempted. And what do you do when you come back? How do you handle this with the humor and so forth? So we decided we'll do a show like we've always done. And we did it. And more people responded by saying thank you. We needed that.
Still tough, though.
Yeah.
Back to the floor we go.
Yeah.
I'll tell you why Wait, Wait and Mike Collins are very popular is because they're so intelligent, along with being entertaining. After hearing you talk here and the telephone clips, do you write your own answering machine messages?
No, we let the... You think I'd write those? No, we let the winner write their own message. And I do what they ask.
You spoke last night, as I mentioned a second ago, to a group of WFA listeners, and one of the things you talked about was the value and future of public radio. So talk about broadcasting today. Public radio seems to me, at least, to be coming into its own. And if we had more money to promote, I think we would be overwhelmingly popular.
Yeah, yeah. It's really doing very well nowadays. It seems that when a crisis comes along, a real thing like 9/11 or the tsunami disaster or something that really touches people, our audience grows tremendously during that period. The first Gulf War, we had a tremendous increase in our listening audience. When people listen, they stay around. The word gets out about NPR. And when people try us, they stay with us. And I think a lot of this has to do with our organization. While the major networks were closing overseas bureaus in the past few years, we were opening overseas bureaus. We have about, I think, 14 now around the world. And we have stringers we can call on. If something happens anywhere, if we can't get our people there, we've got the BBC that we can call upon. So we are there when it happens. And I think that like 9/11, my wife is a psychotherapist, and she said many of her clients told her that they listened to NPR for our coverage because it wasn't that constant bang, 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 war on terror with the music, you know, the television, and the constant picture over and over and over again, the planes hitting those buildings. It was a kind of a calm, reasoned, intelligent discussion and examination of what went on. And I think people like that. It's attractive to them.
That's Carl Castle, recorded in front of a live audience at WFAE in 2005. Carl died this week at the age of 84. He was beloved by NPR listeners across the country for his many decades at the network and by all of us here at WFAE. We'll finish the show with Carl talking on Morning Edition a few years back about his 60 years in radio.
I have enjoyed every minute of it. I have never considered what I do as work. It has been fun, it's been rewarding, and very fulfilling, the whole thing. I love my work. It's been good to me. And it's the best of my world.
Carl Castle plays the best.
The tunes that are your favorite requests.
WGBR is the place to dial no matter where you are. 1150 Carl Castle Show.
The Carl Castle Show.